underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Anne Lamott is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Help, Thanks, Wow, Some Assembly Required, Plan B, and Traveling Mercies. Her work looks to help guide us through the confusion of the world, the complexities of our own hearts, and the complications of understanding relationships with others, children, partners, friends, neighbors, the stranger at the store. In her latest, Hallelujah Anyway, Rediscovering Mercy, she brings her voice and insights to the subject of mercy. What does it mean? Where do we find it? Why do we need it so enormously? She is one of my favorite human beings, and it is a delight to welcome Anne Lamott back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
The book is beautiful, and it seems incredibly timely. And I'm curious as to what your timeline was when you started to look for this rediscovery.
Well, I started it about a year and a half ago when I thought Hillary Clinton was going to be president. And I'm 63 now. And since I was about 6 years old, I've dreamt of a woman president. So I was actually in a pretty good mood. But it seemed that all around me, people felt very anxious and sad and defeated by the modern world and overwhelmed by the speed and the information overload. And so I had noticed around that time that if I said the word mercy or merciful, it could change a person's day because they'd start to, it was like putting on a better pair of glasses, and they would start to feel the stirrings of mercy in their own heart, or they would notice how many people were there for them that day. How much kindness was just coming through to them and through them in the natural course of things. And so I started writing about mercy at that point, not knowing what lay ahead for all of us, for the nation, for the world, but knowing that even where we were a year and a half ago, these are very, very scary times. This is a very vulnerable place, and we're very vulnerable people.
So give us a sense of how you define mercy, of how you look at it. And then I want to open up the discussion a bit to discuss of why then it is so important during these times that you just outlined.
Well, I think mercy is compassion and forgiveness and grace and loving kindness in the Buddhist sense. It's grace is the unmerited assistance and the spiritual WD-40 that helps us go from a very clenched up or stuck place to being able to breathe more easily again. And mercy is more like the action of that. And so the question is, how do we become people of mercy? Because if you think about it, it's the only thing that's ever really worked was people, friends, family, ultimately being able to forgive somebody that they felt was unforgivable, whether it was you or another relative. Mercy, when we're in mercy in ourselves and we feel like helping take care of others, whether it's at a soup kitchen or on the streets or at a family gathering, it's when we feel at our absolutely most whole, like we are the person that we always dreamt of being. So that's why I think it's so devastating to be alive now in these times, and because we're overwhelmed with information and incoming news breaks, and you know, our kids can scare us, and the old people may not have a good solution to where they're going to live now that their spouse has died, and we're just overwhelmed with stuff, both personal and political, and to change channels from that amount of input to becoming a person of mercy and of merciful deeds during the day is huge. It's just radical. So that was the incentive I felt to write the book, was to try to offer, my pastoral says God makes a way out of no way. And I think this path of mercy, of active, merciful behavior is a path out of no way.
You write early in the book, an open, merciful heart is a setup for pain, shame, mm-hmm. and being mocked. We are not stupid. Welcome to vengeance world. The original wound was our parents' belief in punishment, spanking, shame, exile, the silent treatment, isolation. It was pretty convincing. That idea I found interesting, that we have this open, merciful heart that we are born with, but as you believe, it's set up and designed to be ready for the pain.
I was originally calling the book Hallelujah Anyway. I was calling it The Open Drawer, because I had this image that that kids are very merciful and generous. They'll give away their lunches if kids forgot their own. And as a parent or grandparent, you'd be like, don't give away your lunch. But kids are just naturally want to share what they have. They'll give you stuff. And then at about 5, when they hit the blacktop, things change. And they start, you start getting hurt on the blacktop by unthinking kids and bullies and people not paying attention on their bikes or playing kickball. You get hit square on in the face with a kickball. And it all of a sudden, the world is no longer as safe as it was. And nobody seems to be able to protect you. So I felt that people had come with this incredible gift of generosity and mercy, but they had been encouraged by parents and teachers and the culture to put it away, to put it in the drawer, and instead to start to strive to be better than the other kids, to do better, get better grades. I became a tennis champion. I was a very, very good student. And my parents wanted me to pull for people and yet to do better than all of them. And so that sort of screws your sense of this automatic, open-hearted generosity. But you know as well as anyone, Joe, that if you do a few loving things, whether overt or anonymous in the course of a day, you're going to have really loving feelings. Because if you're hungry for that love and connection, you actually provided it, you know? So we put it away in this drawer, and the book was originally The Open Drawer because I was writing about getting it back out, of knowing there's nothing in you. There's nothing you still need to have a peaceful or really fulfilled life with serenity and happiness, but there's stuff you may have to give up. But it's all in the drawer. So I was sort of urging people to open the drawer and start noticing how you were at 5 as opposed to how you were by 13. And somebody said, I can't remember who said it, that we have the exact same things Jesus had, but he didn't have all this extra stuff too. You know, and the extra stuff was this, all the stuff the world breeds in you and your teachers and your family, to do better, to strive for more, to, you know, to pull up the ladder and go into forward thrust no matter how many people get left behind. And first of all, it makes the family look good for you to do really well. And second of all, it makes them just feel that because you're a reflection of them, that they must be doing all right in this world. So, and it doesn't leave anybody any better. It was only an illusion that it made our families look good. And if it made the parents happy or you happy, it was not like something enduring. It was more like a fix or a hit, you know, or a double espresso that it bought you a whole day of feeling superior. Then the next morning you wake up and there's still Swiss cheese holes in our spirit or our being or our soul. So there's nothing on the outside that can give you what you're starving for. It's an inside job. But I believe it is still inside us, inside that drawer. We just have to decide that we are willing to go take a peek and see what we may or may not want to bring forth again into our current lives.
You write that kindness toward others and radical kindness to ourselves buy us a shot at a warm and generous heart, which is the greatest prize of all. Do you want this, or do you want to be right? And you talk about this because it is something that we also want to be right. And at what point, because you even use the word later on in talking about this of surrendering, at some point you have to surrender that idea that you always have to be right.
Well, we're raised that way and we're graded on that. And it makes sense that we're that way. We get a raise based or don't get a raise or a promotion based on that. But it's such a delusion. I feel like God or goodness or whatever you want to call it says to us, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And I always feel like, well, can I get back to you on that? Because I feel that I am right. And if I didn't feel that, I would have different ideas, which I would then feel were the right ideas. So it leads to just craziness and clench and stress. And it's the least attractive quality that you can have in terms of having this natural desire for people to like and esteem us and love us. It's the least attractive thing is this self-righteousness. And especially because it so easily goes hand in hand with being victimized. So, you know, it's like, how much longer do you need to have this? And then you can work with yourself. Well, I'd like to have it for maybe 6 more months. It's fine. You can have it your whole life. You can be a self-righteous victim, or you can break the trance and we could start over right now. And you could go into not needing to be right, knowing people won't ever think you're right anyway, knowing that we don't really change people's mind, knowing that most people are very rarely thinking about you at all. And you can go into this kind of happiness and this silly playfulness and wonder, you know, having this attention and wonder in the world again.
You describe that, and you also make the very valid point that you always have to work on that. It's not just once you see it and you are at that silly, playful place and you have received that mercy, then you still have to be open to it. It's not just a one-time thing, or it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, it's for me, it's true anyway, that, well, the converse is true too. When you go into a really bad place where you're clingy and anxious and, you know, reactive, I always think, well, this is the new me and this it will never pass and this is who I actually am. And then when I find my way to that playful, attentive, watchful, smiling place, it's what heaven seems like it'll be like. And it's always there. I just have to decide to start my new 24 hours over again. It is something to cultivate, is to break the trance of being obsessed with the cell phone or the iPad and instead to be where your butt is, you know, in this world with all of its flaws and sorrows, to be here in the world. Like my older brother, John, quit smoking using that method of stop thought where you put a loose rubber band around your wrist. And when you start to obsess about the craving, you snap it, but very gently, not like people might have hurt you as a child, but very gently. And it's like a plant mister, and it sort of snaps you back to the present moment. And I do that. I put a rubber band on if I'm spending the whole day obsessing about something completely meaningless, like, you know, my weight or something I can't change or some grievance from a year ago that I can still get my dandruff about. I'll just put the rubber band and I'll gently, gently snap it. And then I'll start to smile. I'll go, oh, God, that was a trip. You know, boy, that was a run. And then I'll say to myself, what do you need? Can I get you a nice cup of tea? Can I get you, do you want a bath? Do you want some candy? Just say, I'll go get it for you. And, of course, that radical self-care is where all mercy begins.
Anne Lamott is our guest on this week's book show. The new book is Hallelujah Anyway, Rediscovering Mercy. And it is published by Riverhead Books. You're such a beautiful, you have such beautiful thoughts that you share in this book. And yet you're also very mindful of what we think about, what we should be thinking about, and what we shouldn't be thinking about. And I'm curious as to, do you believe, even in your exploration of mercy and through so much of your work, the possibility and the challenges in overthinking something?
Oh, I mean, every single problem I have comes from overthinking. Every single thing that drives me crazy comes from me sitting up in my little mental airlock chamber like the Wizard of Oz, scheming and trying to figure out how to change other people's behavior and how to get them to stop behaving that way, how to get somebody to just go that extra mile for me. And it's just nuts. It's like a person with 400 cups of coffee or, you know, meth or something, where it's like this ticker tape of thoughts, almost none of which are important, almost all of which have to do with, you know, how my levels are right now and me, Al Franken. And that's a source of misery. And mercy is about, you know, as we were saying, it's about having a heart for other people's troubles. So it's a way to get out of yourself and to become somebody for someone else. But when you're getting outside of yourself, you're getting out of the minefield of your mind. And it's such a wonderful feeling. But I've always was this way. I always thought and I always obsessed. I grew up around parents that weren't very happy, that didn't love each other, and it was a way that I could control and feel a little bit less crazy, was to think and figure out things, figure out what Dad really needed right now, figure out how Mom could be happier and how Dad would be nicer to her and how my brother John would come home. That, you know, I just thought and thought and thought. It was like a wedding planner, but in hell, you know. It was like somebody with... And I could be 7 years old and be doing this. I could be a 55-pound person with a clipboard trying to figure out how everybody else in the world could be happy and therefore love me and nourish me since I was a small child. And it was crazy then, and I still do it left to my own devices. But I'm not left to my own devices now. I'm surrounded by really wise spiritual friends. I have a huge bowl of rubber bands and... I just have to remember what the choice is, that do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? You know, do you want to scheme and figure out stuff that no one's going to believe or act on anyway? Or do you just want to be happy and silly and go outside and take notes on how funny we are, how kind of touching and dear and nuts? Sometimes I do a little bit of writing about all the things that are blowing my mind with how beautiful they are or how touching. And it really gets me out of this sort of gritchy, colicky state of figuring things out and assigning blame. Usually if something happens, my first thought is, whose fault is this and how can I correct their behavior? If I have a rubber band on, I snap it gently. That mental effort will make me laugh, but pretty gently as I get older and older at myself, and I'll roll my eyes at myself.
So when you look at the greater world, we started talking in our conversation, as you said, when you started writing this book, you thought that Hillary Clinton would be president of the United States. She's not. So many of us are having a tough time getting through this situation that we are in as a world. And I'm curious as to how you look with what we've just talked about in regards to mercy and forgiveness and understanding. Do you have to say, okay, this is what I'm doing for me, and realizing that there's really nothing at this immediate time that I can do for these outside forces?
Well, you can always do something for the poor. So that's always where
sure.
I start. Yeah. So a lot of what's been so crazy-making and frustrating is how much has always been allocated for the very old and the very young and the very poor, and how that's all being rethought, let's say, reconsidered, and that we're seeing what looks like a tremendous amount of suffering ahead for those for the very vulnerable and the marginalized, and so what do? Well, we self-fund things. We self-fund art projects for homeless kids. We self-fund, I mean, just off the top of my head, the ACLU or Planned Parenthood or Greenpeace or the Sierra Club for my Jesus-y people. So I had a class with 3 9-year-old girls in it, no one else. I have a Sunday school with, you know, 2 or 3 or sometimes 4 people, but they could be 7 or they could be 17. So it was just curious. They were all 9. And we were talking about how hard it is to be gentle and nice with yourself, and how much easier it is to be nicer to other people, including your incredibly annoying younger sister. And so, and we decided to make a pact that we would all stick to for the week. And so the first rule was you had to talk to yourself exactly the way you would to a friend. The second thing, part of the pact, was that you had to, all three of them and me, were going to pack a box of art supplies for little kids and take it to Goodwill or the Canal Ministry or Salvation Army. I mean, because if you're giving little kids art supplies, you're changing the world, believe me. I mean, as much as possible. And the third thing was that we were going to flirt with old people at the health food store, at Good Earth, or at, you know, the library, because old people are invisible to most of the world. They're not a part of our striving to get ahead and our multitasking and our electronic technical empires that we carry with us in our pockets. And old people just are invisible. And so every single day, the commitment was to stop somebody who is old and to say, "Hi, I love your hat," you know, or something along those lines. Or, "Do you think the cherries are very good? They really don't come in for 3 more months," or whatever. But to, just to convey by stopping and talking and making eye contact that you're glad they're there. So, I mean, it was Mother Teresa who said, none of us can do great things. We can do small things with great love. And I think right now in these dark, medieval, terrifying times, we can do small things every single day with great love. And it changes the world and it changes us. Changes our hearts.
Have you ever felt like this before?
This scared?
Yes.
I had a pretty hard time after the Supreme Court gave the election of 2000 to George Bush and Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney has always been a real struggle for me.
Yeah.
But I had come to feel through prayer and meditation and getting a little bit older that I would wash Dick Cheney's feet, and I believe he would wash mine. And I think forgiveness does not involve wanting to have lunch with the person. You know, it involves understanding that it's hard for everybody here, you know, facing our own death, facing the death of the young ones and the old ones and our aged people who die or get so terribly sick. It's just hard here. And but I would say that this new era of Trump is there is nothing in my brain pan that can accommodate what is going on now in the world and in America. The new ideas he's had about, you know, taking health care away from 24 million people, just off the top of my head, and things along those lines, or doing away with environmental legislation that Obama had in place, or poo-pooing climate change, or staffing the Environmental Protection Agency with climate change deniers. And I mean, just on and on and on. I'm pretty stunned, to say the least. And what I do in the face of that is I take care of the poor.
So to its basic, most fundamental level, is it productive or counterproductive to look at what is being done as what you've just described as evil?
Well, I think it's a really simplistic way, and I think it was a very George Bush way, this Manichaean way of black and white and good and evil, but it's also kind of a useful way. You know, and all the Stephen King books I love were about the forces of good and evil, I don't think it is particularly helpful for me to see them, let's say, just for shorthand, as being evil, or for them to see me and Barack Obama as being evil. But I think what is helpful is to see that the forces of dark are about stinginess and clutching what we have and judging other people and needing to put people down, needing to see other people as inferior. Those are the forces of darkness and bigotry. That's the path of death. And the forces of good are generosity and taking time for kids. Somebody is obviously troubled. You can sit with them for 10 minutes. You can get a little bit less done today. You can pick up the cleaning tomorrow. You can get the graph paper at Walgreens Thursday right after lunch. You're going to be right there. And instead, you can sit with somebody who's feeling really, really isolated and scared. And I think those are the forces of good, are the giving forces and the listening forces. The greatest force for good is listening. And so you can choose to be on the side of of goodness and attention to others and caring and having a heart for other people's troubles.
Anne Lamott's latest is Hallelujah Anyway, Rediscovering Mercy. It is published by Riverhead. Anne, it is always a great pleasure and a treat for me to speak to you. I thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Sharing.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
See you soon. Yeah.
Again, Anne Lamott's latest is Hallelujah Anyway, Rediscovering Mercy. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.